Welcome to the podcast series Museums in Motion. My name is Richard Bussmann. I'm a professor of ethnology at the University of Cologne. I'm pleased to welcome to our interview today Dr. Alice Stevenson, Associate Professor of Museum Studies at University College London. Good morning, Alice.
Good morning.
Alice, you have a rather unique research profile in Egyptology. Would you like to expand a little on your research interests and your projects?
Yes. So I always describe myself as one of these archaeologists that, you know, doesn't dig, and an Egyptologist that doesn't read hieroglyphs, and a museum person that doesn't do much in the way of exhibitions. So what is it that I do? So I spend a lot of my time thinking about how we know what we know in archaeology through collections, how knowledge is formed through assemblages of things. And that's not just assemblages as material assemblages. I'm interested in them, yes, what they tell us about the ancient past, but I'm also interested in them as social assemblages and how those assemblages have come together and the politics and context in which they've been formed. So I spend a lot of my time sort of flitting between the ancient past, usually Victorian, 19th century, early 20th century. And of course, the legacies of that in 21st century contemporary.
In your book, Scattered Finds, you are referring to multi-sided approaches in ethnography. And you argue that collections should be viewed in wider context of knowledge making in a society. Could you explain the theoretical foundations of your research? How would you position your research relative to current debates in museum and heritage studies?
Yeah, so one of the foundations is that we, through the Artifacts of Excavation project, developed this idea of object habits. And that's this idea that the way in which we understand museum collections is not just a product of disciplinary cultures. So, for example, I'm an archaeologist or an Egyptologist, and I see these collections through my education that way. It's also informed by the society in which, you know, I live in. So, you know, for the Victorian world, you know, discussions around evolution, the position of objects in knowledge, the way in which objects were such a key foundation for knowing the world in that period, which is different to the post-war period when museums started to get rid of objects again. And why was that? It wasn't just because disciplinary cultures changed. It was also because of the geopolitics of the post-war period. So I'm particularly interested in how our current language, the current terms, really frame how we perceive these collections, how we perceive ancient Egypt in the 21st century. Museums right now have a considerable visibility in public discourse. So I think we see increasingly media headlines, we see documentaries, magazine articles, all about decolonization, and we see this buzzword. But what I'm trying to do in my research is to really to dig deeper below those headlines, to really understand the histories, but also to understand museum cultures as well. Institutions are very complex organizations of different agencies, from your marketing department through to conservation to your collections managers, and all of them constrain and enable how you see and what you can do with collections.
In our research group, we look at different types of museums, so archaeological museums, ethnographic, art historical, historical. I think there are certain themes that unite these different types of museums and also others that separate them, which is not a bad thing. I don't think it's a problem to be different. I think one of the differences might be a different relationship between the objects and the source communities. How would you describe this relationship in the case of Egyptian archaeology, which deals with a record of the remote past?
So I think Egyptology has a particular challenge. I think in actual fact, Egyptology has been a bit of a blind spot where it comes to anthropological approaches. You know, we've seen the crisis of representation in ethnographic museums, and they've been grappling with the need to engage with indigenous communities, source communities of all types for, you know, several decades. But what I found working with ethnographic museums, not just the Pitt Rivers, but more recently the Horniman Museum, is that Egypt tends to be it's very exceptional. It has become such a normalized part of the fabric of museums that it's not being questioned. It's not being critiqued in the same way as collections, say, from North America or the Pacific. So you see, you know, I've seen these new gallery developments, which are very attentive to co-curation with ensuring that anthropological approaches like the contact zone are realized and thought through critically and how they display and represent African collections. But then Egypt is just being reproduced with the same tropes. Oh, excellent, we have a mummy that'll attract the public, or, you know, this will make a great piece for the education program for schools. And we don't see the same sort of consideration for the source communities.
In the report of Benedict Savoy and Ferry Winsart, 2018, to the French President Macron, they are writing in a footnote that Egypt should be considered differently from the rest of the African continent for various reasons, one of them being that despite the large-scale removal of objects from the country in the 19th century, there's still a mass of objects and monuments still in Egypt. Do you agree?
No. I think there is an exceptionalism, but I think that still needs to be critically dealt with. The idea that it's simply the massive material and that there's plenty still in Egypt somehow makes it unproblematic. I think one of the things that's come out through the course of the research I've been doing over the last decade is the extraordinary spread of Egyptian material culture to the world globally. I mean, millions of objects in every continent. I mean, artifacts of excavation alone, which just looked at British colonial archaeology from 1880, nothing else. We found 350 museums, you know, in 27 countries that had received material through, you know, British archaeologists.
And an historian of the a German historian of the more recent past has proposed a term, communities of implication, part of which means that we are implied in histories of objects that others have made. So in the case of Egyptian objects, of course, I mean, there are an exciting source, an exciting window into the lives of people in of the remote past. It is not very simple to know anything about what happened 4,000 years ago. So objects remain a very important type of source, but they also embody histories of colonial extractivism, injustice, supremacy, and so forth. So how would you envision a future for Egyptian archaeology and Egyptian collections that takes over responsibility for this history?
So one of the things that we have seen in recent museum galleries is a move to embracing object biographies and the broader agencies behind collections. But what we've seen is how the global is localized is often with regard to local communities, not including diaspora Egyptian communities, but you know, local Western personalities, you know. So Marianne Brocklehurst gave money to the Egypt Exploration Society, so she is part of the agency of this collection. So we're still foregrounding Western protagonists, even when we're now, you know, extending the view to include more women. But what we have is this extraordinary archive that is a clear testament to the Egyptian hands behind that. You know, you've got Stephen Quirk and his work on Hidden Hands and the wealth of the archives, which allow us to reveal the agencies behind those collections. There is this extraordinary, imperial nostalgia, which is this term, and we particularly see it with Egypt collections, the golden age of collecting Tutankhamun in the 1920s. And so we see often the marketing of Egyptian collections caged in a kind of imperialist nostalgia.
If we're trying to listen to what Egyptian voices may be, I think one of the problems is that Egyptology emerged outside Egypt, in Europe, in the US, and it continues shaping the discipline. So what we know about ancient Egypt is basically something that has been produced in Europe and the US, and even in other countries, including in Egypt, this kind of knowledge is learned, so it's becoming more and more difficult to hear anything that is not shaped by the research agendas that have been established over the past 200 years. So would you say that Egyptian objects can still be a productive site for, I think Helen Varan calls it ontological happenings for a clash of different worldviews?
Oh, absolutely. So in the current Egypt's Dispersed Heritage Project, we took forward this idea from Laura Pierce and Alison Brown about objects as being contact zones for a place of clash of cultures. And so we worked with a series of UK museums who provided us with images and archives, and we took those to Egypt, where my colleague Heba Abdul El Gawad worked with a series of artists and comic artists to create stories with inspiration. But the key point about that was that those stories were produced entirely by the comic artists. We handed this material over so that those communities could produce stories using their own cultural references and their own idioms that were meaningful to them. And so what this has allowed us to develop is so there's a series of comics by an artist called Nasser Jr. So, for example, he had one which was about being told this story of the distribution of objects. And while he's being told this story, he's wrapping himself in toilet paper. And, Heba Ab, who's in the comic, looks up and goes, "What are you doing?" And he goes, "Ooh, well, maybe if I'm a mummy, I get to travel."
Yeah, thank you very much, Ellis. I'd like to open the floor for a wider discussion. I think you've mentioned a couple of very interesting keywords that some of the colleagues in the research group might wish to pick up in a discussion. So any questions to Ellis?
I was wondering, because when I studied in Cairo and I was always impressed that many Egyptian intellectuals were very proudly stressing that they were Egyptians and not Arabs. I wonder how this has maybe changed today and how different groups within Egypt assess this heritage of ancient Egypt.
What's really interesting is Egypt throughout history being at that juncture in the Mediterranean, with the Gulf, with North Africa, with sub-Saharan Africa. The majority of my colleagues are just so proud to be Egyptian. And they really see this heritage as defining how they use ancient Egypt as part of the way in which they define themselves today. But that might also be in tension with how the state has appropriated ancient Egypt. So you also have, how do you get these more personal and local interactions, regional identities, is not necessarily the way in which the state has also co-opted ancient Egypt.
I think there's a wider discussion to be had alongside this history of Egyptology, of thinking about Egypt's position in and relationship with the African continent.
You're absolutely right. There's a fascinating history of Egyptology and Egyptian collecting in Africa. And, I did a little bit of work in Ghana, where the National Museum of Ghana, and on the night, the National Museum opened the day before independence, and ancient Egypt was an absolutely core part of their displays. And Kwame Nkrumah and the, his Pan-Africanism and his friendship with, Egyptian politicians really shaped a particular vision of Egypt in Ghana. Absolutely fascinating. And there were archaeologists from Ghana under colonial administrators who then went to Nubia to excavate during the UNESCO campaigns. So Ghana was one of the missions, and they had postage stamps celebrating the Ghanaian flag juxtaposed with the Aswan monuments.
And I have children in eighth grade now, and when I see what they do in the history books and how they are taught civilization, for example, this term in German is, I don't know whether you use it also in English, high civilization, Hochkultur. Civilization, and they don't question the use. They have their criteria, and they learn it, and that's how it is. And so, doesn't have to be more complicated with more institutions, right deep down to school curricula?
No, absolutely agreed. And actually, I'm trying to develop a project at the moment with the Institute of Education at UCL to address just this, because one of the ways in which our stereotyped notions of Egypt are being reproduced is through the British education system. Ancient Egypt is one of the sanctioned sort of ancient civilizations to study and the most popular. And so museums put a lot of effort into developing their Egypt displays to cater to those stakeholders. And so, for example, one of the things we found at the Horniman Museum was they'd done all this great work. You know, they've done, you know, a critical display on the Benin bronzes addressing colonial violence to some degree. They've worked with the Haida and First Nations to develop those displays. But then you've got ancient Egypt, which is just textbook, you know, cut and paste. You know, here's a mummy. Here's some amulets. They believed in some gods. Absolutely. You know, there's no... You know, it's ancient Egypt as a concept. It's not a time, it's not a place, it doesn't have people in it living today. It's just this set of, you know, that just gets reproduced. And that, so yeah, absolutely, that work has to be done with the schools. So we've been developing education handling boxes using modern Egyptian craft products to start talking about, you know, contemporary Egyptian ways in which they are, you know, using the heritage around them to create new objects.
How do archaeologists that do dig relate to your work, and do you see an institutional opening towards wider interdisciplinary cooperations?
We find that the students are, you know, they don't just want to find about the ancient past, they are very motivated by contemporary discourse. They want to deal with these issues. So there's been a lot of receptiveness to developing interdisciplinary programs. That where it starts to get a bit difficult is where you know, with breadth, you sacrifice depth. So, you know, you get to that question of archaeology, specialisms, and how do you progress in the profession? Well, then you need a master's to specialize a bit more, then you need a PhD, and then I mean, so my interdisciplinarity has come out of the fact that, you know, I did a degree, another degree, another degree, 6 years of being a postdoc in multiple institutions, working in a museum, and then going back into, you know, working in academia directly. So that took a very long time to see those different institutions and to see those different, you know, I'm trying to bring that experience back into the curriculum.
And I was wondering if you have any specific idea that we should address or that you would like to address about this sort of heritage discourse in your work. I mean, how do you deal with the problematics of it? Yeah.
I think one of the fundamental responsibilities that we have now is, you know, in teaching archaeology, is that there has to be non-optional courses on understanding the politics and history of, you know, in which archaeology happens. So that's something that I've been working with my colleague, Khorasan Fenwick, who teaches Islamic archaeology. And we've now created a core module. It is compulsory for anyone who wants to, you know, specialize in the Middle East and Mediterranean. If you want to practice archaeology in those regions, you have to study a course on the politics.
Thank you again, Alice, for this wonderful interview and for this very exciting discussion. So it was great to meet up again.
Yeah, no,
hopefully next time in person.